Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's so bad about being wrong? We all know how great it feels to be right. We love to shout out the correct answer to Jeopardy questions. We love to be the partner telling the other which direction to turn the car on the way to dinner. And we relish the occasional opportunity to say, I told you so. But the inverse of that sort of joy is the agony we experience when we get things wrong. Suddenly, our smugness morphs to embarrassment, leaving us annoyed, defensive, and desperate to find somebody who sees things our way. And yet we are guaranteed to be wrong about certain things pretty much every day. And while the consequences of our miscalculations can be trivial or terrible, my guest today is convinced that human fallibility is worth understanding and even embracing. Catherine Schultz is a journalist who has written for publications including the New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Foreign Policy. Her new book is called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Catherine, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You write, as absurd as it sounds, our steady state seems to be of unconsciously assuming we are almost omniscient. That sentence makes me laugh, but I have to admit it's true.
Yeah, you know, you and all of us, I think most of us do go around in kind of a background state of assuming that our basic convictions about the world are correct. And obviously, if we stopped to really think about it, we would all concede, at least in the abstract, that some of our beliefs must be wrong. But it's pretty tough to get through day-to-day life if you don't have that assumption that essentially most of what you think about is pretty reliable and trustworthy and you can count on it.
We even get a kick out of being right about things that are ultimately pretty unpleasant. What explains that?
Well, we get a kick out of being right about those things, especially if they aren't happening to us.
Sure.
but, yeah, you know, this to me is one of the things that's very interesting about our relationship to rightness and wrongness is it persists almost regardless of the content of what we're right or wrong about. So we hate being wrong, even about completely trivial things. And as you point out, we get a kind of glee out of being right, even about things like, you know, a downturn in the stock market that we managed to foresee, or, you know, a friends of ours who go through a divorce when we'd predicted all along that they weren't going to last. And I think in all of these cases, even when there's something negative happening, we ourselves experience a kind of positive affirmation when we've called it correctly.
What do you think we gain from understanding how we think and feel about being wrong?
Well, for starters, I would say that our attitudes toward being right and being wrong have a remarkably, I would almost say, omnipresent influence on our lives. They affect how we conduct ourselves at work, at home, in the political sphere, in the private domain. And in that sense, it behooves us, given, you know, how much these attitudes matter, to understand where they come from. Because I think most of us share a set of ideas and attitudes about wrongness and yet don't really stop to think about them. For instance, most of us tend to feel like being wrong is embarrassing, humiliating, also relatively rare, a kind of strange anomaly that flies into our lives. And, you know, most of us probably also share in the abstract the idea that, you know, being wrong is relatively natural and happens to everyone. That is also part of our set of cultural ideas about wrongness. However, when it comes to being wrong about something specific, that usually flies out the window pretty quickly, and we go right back to feeling embarrassed about it.
We should say this book is not about right and wrong in the moral sense, and yet it's pretty much impossible to talk about wrongness without exploring this long history we have of associating correctness with virtue and incorrectness with evil.
That's right. I didn't set out to write a book about moral rights and wrongs, the kinds of things we might think of as, you know, iniquity or sin. But as you say, it turns out to be impossible to look at the other kind of wrongness without considering moral issues. And there's many reasons for that. One is that, as you suggest, these ideas are very closely related in our minds. It's not an accident, I would say, that we use the word wrong to refer to both of these kinds of, you know, what we might call error versus what we might call, you know, ethical infractions or even sin. And it's also the case that some of our most dramatic experiences of wrongness concern being wrong about a moral belief. And those oftentimes are the ones that really shake our worldview and force us to confront what it means to hold a belief and what it feels like when it collapses out from under us.
Well, it also speaks to the fact, Catherine, that many of us tend to look at our morality as an objective thing as opposed to a subjective perception.
That's exactly right. I think most of us hold the moral beliefs we do because we believe that they're grounded in a set of facts. So to take an outdated example, if you think about something like phrenology, this was the kind of 19th century belief that you could understand human intelligence and ethics by inspecting the shape of the skull, essentially, and that in fact you could detect differences between blacks and whites, men and women, quote, natives and, quote, foreigners, by examining skull shape. Now, this science has been completely discredited, but at the time, it supported an entire moral system, an entire way of thinking about different peoples and cultures in what was thought to be a basis of fact. So there's a situation where, you know, if you had a moral belief that women were intellectually inferior to men, you could claim and you would certainly feel that your belief, that moral position was simply grounded in the real truth about the world.
So not only is it hard to admit that we're wrong, it's often downright hard to realize it. Because as you remind us here, being wrong feels pretty much exactly like being right until we're presented with evidence to the contrary.
That's right. And I think it's actually a really important point about wrongness. So I'll say a little bit more about it. You know, it's obviously, you know, as you say, there's a distinction between admitting we're wrong and realizing that we're wrong. And they're both hard in their own way. You know, making a public acknowledgement of our errors is quite difficult for many people. But before you can even get there, you have to get to the step of the internal realization of, you know, whoops, I blew that one. And as you say, you know, that realization of being wrong is very different from the experience of simply being wrong. When we realize that we're wrong about something, there's a whole lot of emotions that can follow from that. We can be a little bit embarrassed. We can get defensive. We can be intrigued and curious. It can be funny. It can be illuminating. But there's an emotion associated with it. There's a feeling. By contrast, when we are wrong, not when we've realized it, but when we're just kind of going about our lives in some state or holding on to some belief that we're later going to decide is wrong, there's absolutely no feeling to indicate that. In fact, the crucial point about being wrong is that while it's happening, it feels exactly like being right. So there's not any internal subtle cue we can pick up on that can illuminate us. We just, you know, carry on feeling, you know, perfectly content in our sureness that we're right about things.
Sometimes when we get evidence that maybe something that we have believed to be true is not, the first thing we do is run around looking for confirmation of what we thought to be true in the first place.
That's right, and this is an incredibly pervasive human phenomenon. If you believe something, you're instinctively going to look for evidence that supports that belief, unless you've been consciously trained otherwise. Now, that training is quite simple. Every scientist in the world knows to look for counter-evidence instead of evidence. It's something that you can inculcate in people, you can educate them about this, and it's not a difficult skill to acquire. But unless you consciously pause and decide to look for counter-evidence, you're going to look instead only for evidence that supports your theories. And this is a very basic human phenomenon. It's very widely documented. There's some reasons why it makes sense as a kind of baseline reasoning strategy. But of course, it also serves us very poorly in some other circumstances, because it means that once we already believe something, we're only going to register the evidence that supports it, and we're going to be either resistant to or simply blind to the evidence that contradicts it.
And our friends, in many cases, are likely to hold the same misconceptions we hold.
They are, and that makes it even more unlikely that we're ever going to entertain any challenges to our beliefs. Most of us sort ourselves into communities, into neighborhoods, into friendship groups of all kinds on the basis of shared beliefs. And this is, sociologists call this phenomenon homophily. We like to hang out with people who are like us. They share our beliefs, they share our ideas, and that's a, you know, lovely experience, of course, and there's something I think very precious to all of us of feeling affirmed in our beliefs about the world. But again, it also poses a real danger in terms of our exposure to counter-evidence, because if we simply never interact with people who hold different views than ours, then we're never really going to hear about what might be valid or interesting or worthwhile about those views.
And then when we think other people are wrong, it can have a serious impact on our respect for them, our trust for them. Suddenly, they're sort of outside the group with regard to whatever that is.
Right. In the book, I refer to this as a series of kind of dangerous assumptions we tend to make when people disagree with us. And the first assumption most people make when someone disagrees with a deeply held view of your own is that they're simply ignorant, that they haven't been exposed to the same information that you have, and if you share that information with them, they'll come around and share your viewpoint. And then when that doesn't work out, when you go ahead and supposedly enlighten them and they still disagree with you, many people are very quick to conclude, oh, they're not ignorant, they're idiotic. You know, they have access to this same information that I have, but they don't have the brains to correctly interpret it. And when that assumption also falls apart and it turns out, well, you know, this person is informed and they're smart and they still disagree with me, then we tend to take this third step, which is the assumption that, oh, they're actually evil. You know, this person has the right information, they're smart enough to interpret it, but they're morally bankrupt. They're actually seeking out and supporting falsehood for some devious reason of their own. And these three assumptions, that people who disagree with us are either ignorant or idiotic or evil, are remarkably pervasive in our lives, in our public discourse, in our political scene, and, you know, as you can probably infer, pretty dangerous, a pretty unhelpful way to think about people who disagree with us.
Well, sure, because once we've gone to the evil stage with regard to labeling somebody, it's pretty hard to build back decent, healthy communication with that person.
It sure is. In fact, describing somebody as evil is a relatively surefire way to, I would say, cut off all civil communications that might have otherwise been possible.
Talk about how our distaste for being wrong ourselves affects our everyday relationships. Because, you know, anyone who has a spouse or a partner or coworkers, it happens all the time that we think we're right and we think they're wrong.
It happens all the time. And in some ways, I think it happens all the time in those contexts, in part just because these are, after all, the people we're most intimate with. We spend the most time with them. And one consequence of that is that we're forced into constantly making shared decisions, whether those are about what time the kid should go to bed or how we should respond to the news that, you know, our kid got involved in some kind of trouble at school, or completely trivial things like, you know, which brand of tuna fish to buy or whatever. When you're in a really intimate relationship with someone else, all of those decisions essentially present the opportunity for one person's idea of right and another person's idea of right to come into conflict. And that's bad enough. And then I think what makes it worse, especially in intimate relationships with spouses, partners, as opposed to just with coworkers, is that we're involved in kind of an implicit bargain with the people we share our lives with. And I think that bargain goes something like, hey, you're supposed to affirm my worldview all the time. And so when that person doesn't, even if it's in a relatively trivial context, it feels frustrating and it feels like a kind of betrayal. And, you know, if we look for our friends and our community to support our beliefs in a general way, I think we look to our family members to support them really powerfully and specifically. And so it can really create a lot of tension when you get those kinds of, you know, I'm right, no, I'm right moments in relationships, which, of course, you get all the time.
Yeah, and agreeing to disagree is almost impossible because it's always going to be there in the background.
Right. I think agreeing to disagree, while a useful tool to have in the tool chest, is not typically that conducive to real peace and harmony in relationships. I think what's more effective is agreeing to actually entertain the possibility that your partner has a point. You know, the possibility that, hey, you know what, maybe I'm wrong on this one, or maybe there's not a clear-cut right and wrong, which is, you know, very often the case in these situations, and we can talk it out and come to some sort of understanding, at least, of the other person's position on this one.
Journalist Catherine Schultz is my guest. Her new book is called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communications start weekly in September. Details at smu.edu/think.
Yeah.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Catherine Schultz. Her new book is called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I was also really intrigued by the point you make here that we can really only get upset about things that we think we know for sure. I was thinking about the fact that I don't follow sports. I don't care much for sports. I could never get in a big fight with somebody about which team was going to win, even if I had a favorite team. And yet this is something that some people will really go toe-to-toe over.
I'm with you there. Yeah, I can't really be provoked into a fight over sports either. Yeah, I think that very often it's quite difficult to get angry about something unless rightness or wrongness are on the line. We often get angry when we're totally convinced that we're right and we feel that we can't get our point across. And we also get angry when we realize that we're wrong. And anger kicks in, I think, as essentially a defense mechanism because we experience a moment of shame or humiliation over having been wrong and having, you know, strongly backed an idea that we now realize is erroneous. And rather than figure out a way to face up to that and step back and acknowledge it, which typically actually leads to a much nicer and warmer outcome for everyone involved, we resort to anger to cover up for that experience.
Why do you think we extend our ideas about right and wrong to things like taste, which really shouldn't matter to anyone else? But, you know, you turn on any TV show and you watch someone getting a makeover or having their rooms redone, and you will have some expert explaining why a particular sofa or a particular hairstyle is absolutely wrong.
Right. Taste is a wonderful example of how our ideas of right and wrong play out, in part because all of us understand that these are actually not the right yardsticks for matters of taste. You know, we understand that right and wrong aren't particularly relevant in that domain. In fact, by the time you're very, very young, you realize that things like favorite colors, to take an example that's relevant to young children, there's not a right or wrong about that. I can, you know, my favorite color can be blue, and my best friend Sally's favorite color can be yellow, and that's fine. And yet, it's very, very easy to get people to start acting as if there is an objective truth in these matters. And, you know, if I say, ugh, you know, I really dislike blueberry muffins and you passionately love them, you're going to come along and say something like, oh, you just haven't had my mom's blueberry muffins. And what's interesting to me about that is it's actually quite similar to the attitude toward belief that we were talking about earlier, where what's at issue is, oh, you just haven't been presented with the right set of facts. And in both cases, I think, and this is why I would say right and wrong do come into play even in matters of taste, we find it a little bit hard to believe that people don't share our worldview. From our own perspective, you know, we're kind of at the center of our own tiny universe and things look a certain way. And even when we know better, it can be surprisingly difficult to fully relinquish that and say, you know what, that's how it looks from where I stand, it's how it tastes, it's the movie I like, but that's not a universal. And not everybody, you know, would share that. And the fact that they don't share it doesn't mean that they just don't, you know, have the right education, sensitivity, judgment, or so forth. They just disagree with me.
So let's talk for a minute about why we tend to get things wrong. Our brains are set up to make a lot of quick shortcuts in assessment of things, how things are. And typically that actually serves us pretty well, but it's not foolproof.
It serves us extremely well, and I think that's one of the crucial points about wrongness. You know, in recent decades, the habit of our minds to, as you say, use shortcuts to arrive at answers has come under quite a lot of criticism, as if this were a faulty, shoddy method for arriving at our ideas about the world. The fact of the matter is, yes, we do take shortcuts all the time, but no, that's not at all a faulty, shoddy method. In fact, we've yet to come up with anything even approximating the power of this shortcut method. Scientists, neuroscientists, and psychologists call that method essentially inductive reasoning is the easiest way to think about it. And you might characterize inductive reasoning essentially as educated guesses. We reach a conclusion based on whatever evidence we've been exposed to in the past. It's the most logical, speediest, most efficient, and most flexible way we have to come to conclusions about the world. And odds are we're going to be right. The world is not completely predictable, but it is somewhat predictable. And if things have occurred a certain way in the past, there's you know, some higher likelihood that they will occur that way in the future. So this way of thinking allows us to be right an extraordinary amount of the time, but it also means that inevitably some percentage of the time, that's probably slightly less than 50%, we're also going to get it wrong.
Yeah, it's funny. The phrase jumping to conclusions was something that in elementary school was thrown around like the worst thing you could possibly do. But if you never jump to conclusions, you'd waste a lot of time.
Yeah, I love the phrase jumping to conclusions because we only use that phrase when we actually mean jumping to wrong conclusions. But the reality is we jump to conclusions all the time, and very often they're correct. And nobody accuses you in those moments of being a lazy, shoddy, you know, imprecise thinker. They think you're brilliant and quick on your feet. And yet it's the exact same mechanism at work that occasionally will produce bad results and get you accused of jumping to conclusions.
Catherine Schultz is my guest. Her book is called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. We'll go on the phones now at 1-800-933-5372 to Susan in Denton. Hello, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for having my call.
Sure.
My comment earlier when the discussion was about a couple and that you end up acquiescing alternately, you know, hopefully alternately, to the other person, and I anticipated a discussion being said about being a single parent in regard to decisions that as the parent you are making on your own, and you know, you do the best you can and you come up with something, and then you're left to stand as a solid one to say to your kids, that's the way it is and that's the way we're doing it. And then as they grow up, that's when you see, well, maybe I was wrong about that one. And, you know, you pat yourself in the back over a couple, but of things that, you know, or a few things, or hopefully the majority of things that you've done correctly. But a comment on that thing that I think a lot of single parents wish they had a good cop, bad cop scenario, so that you've got somebody to stand by you or somebody to go, you know, maybe we should look at it like this.
It is tough. And I've been there, Susan. And the issue is that it's pretty much all on you in those cases.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Catherine?
I think it's a really insightful comment, and I'm so glad you brought up both the issue of parenting and the issue of single parenting. To the issue of single parenting, you know, I think there's so many situations in life where we would be better off if we had someone at our side saying, well, okay, what about this other way? What if we try this instead? What if we try that instead? And sometimes we have those people and we're reluctant to listen to them, and sometimes we simply don't have them. And it is really tough to see all the options when you're just standing up there alone and having to figure it out. And I think there might be no domain where that's as true, as consequential feeling, and as constant as the domain of single parenting, where you really are forced on the fly to come up with decisions, choices, ground rules all the time, and then, you know, try to kind of muddle through and stand by them or alter them to the best of your own abilities. And I would say about parenting in general that I think that, you know, there might be no domain of life as well suited to instruct us in our fallibility. You know, I think parenting is incredibly hard. It's the consummate task of kind of navigating the unknown and the unpredictable. Every kid is different. New situations crop up every day. There's no training. There's nothing to prepare you either for the big picture or for what might happen at any given moment. And so you're really working it out on the fly. And I think that for many people, it's very, very humbling and teaches them really good lessons about humility and fallibility. And for many people, I think that degree of lack of control and the sort of scariness of trying to get it right really actually makes them tremendously fearful of being wrong. And I think that's why you sometimes get, I don't know if you've ever spent time on, like, you know, parenting listservs or even for that matter, listening to gossip on playgrounds, but there can often be a real attachment to, like, this is the right way to do it, and anyone who's not doing it this way is a terrible parent. And I think some of that arises out of a real fear of somehow getting it wrong.
Well, there's no question that clinging to something, even if we're challenged in terms of whether or not it's actually right and true, makes us feel much more in control than stepping back and saying, you know what, I think I had that wrong.
That's true. I think that for many people, a clear, certain, wrong answer is more comfortable than uncertainty. It's more comfortable than sitting there in the middle of doubt and, you know, realizing that what you thought was wrong and you're not quite sure what to think next and you're temporarily a little bit adrift on this sea of, as I said, uncertainty. And I think that is hard, and many people in the face of that kind of doubt will opt instead for anything that feels like solid ground, at least on the emotional level, even if, you know, intellectually, pragmatically, it's actually not correct. It's not solid ground.
The other thing Susan said about, you know, stepping back years later and looking at how things have turned out and saying, oh, I was wrong on that, points to something that you bring up in the book, which I think is so interesting. We never say, I am wrong. We say, I was wrong, always with the implicit assumption that we now are correct, that always in the present we are right.
Yeah, this is one of the interesting things about wrongness, and it relates to what I was saying earlier about how, you know, there's no indication in the moment that we're wrong about something. You know, nobody sets out to hold a false belief. So if we knew we were doing it, we would just presumably stop doing it right away. And the corollary to that is that it's very hard to believe that we're wrong in the present tense. You know, we might have been wrong 2 minutes ago about something, and never mind all of the many, many occasions we've been wrong in the past. They don't seem to add up to the notion that, oh, I could be wrong again right now. Whatever we currently believe feels to us like the equivalent of true belief, no matter what's happened in the past.
We have an email here from Dan in Plano who writes, why does it seem we can agree to disagree about almost anything except when it comes to religion and politics? These seem to be absolutes.
Hmm. You know, I think in both of those domains, there's so much at stake, both as a practical matter and as an emotional matter. I mean, when you take something like religion, religion speaks to our largest possible sense of the organization of the world around us. And feeling like we understand the world in its most meaningful sense, you know, maybe we don't know whether the hotel is north or south of here, maybe we're not sure if our airplane leaves at 8 in the morning or 8 at night, that is trivial compared to knowing, you know, was the world ordered and designed? Is there good? Is there evil? What will happen to me after death? What has happened to my loved ones who have died? Those kinds of beliefs, I think, bring tremendous peace and clarity to people who otherwise live, as we all do, in a world that actually, you know, is not notable for constant peace and clarity. In fact, it's notable for a certain measure of chaos and randomness and lack of control. And so I think when you threaten that kind of peace and order that are offered by religion by presenting a countering view, a different view, it's very, very destabilizing for people and creates a kind of anxiety that's so uncomfortable that your listener is correct. There's actually not room for disagreement. It's simply too scary.
One of our favorite repeat guests on the show is a sort of philosopher rabbi named Brad Hirschfield. I don't know if you know his work, but his most recent book was called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, which is a great way, I think, to look at it, but it's hard to get there.
It's very hard to get there, and all the more so in matters of religion, where, you know, many, if not most religions, are, of course, you know, established on the notion that there is actually one truth. Many religions are in pursuit of truth in the same way that much of early philosophy was in pursuit of truth. And if you think that your religion offers the one and only road to understanding the universe and understanding truth and reality, then actually, yeah, there is one right and everything else is wrong. And that, of course, is the source of a vast amount of conflict.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Bill in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
Hi. You spoke about religious faith, and I'm reminded of the phrase opiate of the people. You know, this is the kind of thing that soothes people's psyches, religious faith, even though there is a randomness, a chaos, and so forth.
I think that's true, and I think we turn to many different sources to try to achieve some measure of peace and stability in the face of what, as I suggested earlier, is fundamentally a pretty uncontrollable world around us. I have to say that in my own research into wrongness, with the exceptions of what I would consider the sort of most dogmatic, extremist fringes, it's not my experience that religion is more or less of a source of conflict over wrongness than many other things. I think it's possible to be a devout person and grapple very deeply with ideas of rightness and wrongness. In fact, if you look to the history of how we think about error, many, many religious thinkers from Aquinas to Augustine, I could go on and on, have thought very movingly and thoughtfully about error. And in fact, I think many people who are very religious have had to grapple really extensively with doubt. And to me, doubt and certainty are very closely related to the idea of rightness and wrongness. And through that process of grappling with doubt have really shed quite a lot of light on our relationship to error. And I think, you know, we are all capable of getting dogmatic about a great many things, and our religious beliefs are certainly on the list, but they aren't the sum and substance of the list.
Well, it seems to me that if there's one thing that is more disquieting to us than the idea that we might in fact be wrong, it's the idea that something can't be known for sure.
I think that's right. In fact, I think a lot of our relationship to being wrong is fundamentally a relationship to being in doubt. I would say that the more comfortable you are with doubt and uncertainty, the more graceful you're likely to be in the face of your errors. Because the thing about getting something wrong is that, you know, in some cases you get something wrong and you immediately realize what the right answer is. You know, whoops, turn left, should have turned right. That's not a tricky one. It's probably not going to create any existential crisis for anybody. But there are other situations where larger beliefs are on the line, where entertaining the possibility that you're wrong or actually having a whole belief system collapse out from under you really does leave you very uncertain about, well, if that was wrong, what is right? And is there a right? And can I even ever find solid ground again? And for many people, that's really disquieting. Now, for other people, I think that doubt and uncertainty are actually, I would almost go so far as to say comforting. You know, they remind us that there is always something new out there to look for, and that's why I think the word curiosity slipped in by accident. That kind of doubt can lead us to curiosity and discovery of the best sorts.
Journalist Catherine Schultz is my guest. Her book is called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communications start weekly in September. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Catherine Schultz. Her new book is called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. I want to talk, Catherine, about what seems to be the core message of the book, which is that it is not only inevitable and okay to be wrong, in fact, it's a real opportunity for growth, depending on how you look at it.
That is the core message of the book in many ways. And I should preface it by saying that the point I'm trying to make isn't that all mistakes are, you know, wonderful and benevolent or at the very least benign. There's no question that there are errors that we would all hope to avoid at all costs. I'm thinking about things like medical errors or mistakes in aviation or, you know, for instance, in oil drilling. To take a recent example, there's certainly contexts and situations where the stakes are so high that mistakes can be really catastrophic, and we should try to, you know, prevent them or at the very least prevent their negative consequences. So the point I'm trying to make isn't that mistakes themselves are intrinsically wonderful, although many of them I think can lead to wonderful discoveries and inventions and creations and so forth. Instead, I think the central message of the book is that error is an inevitable part of being human, and it's not an inevitable part like warts or like hangnails. It's an inevitable part of a good system, of something and many things about ourselves that we really cherish: our intelligence, our creativity, our capacity to invent, to create, to be courageous. And in no way would we ever seek to eradicate these parts of ourselves. And as long as we want to retain and fact, enhance things like human intelligence. We need to accept that our capacity to err is really part and parcel of that package. And I think that with that acceptance comes a very different attitude toward error that can in turn have a much more positive effect, pardon me, on our relationships. And we talked earlier about intimate relationships with, family members, spouses. But I would say the same goes true, with relationships with our coworkers, our neighbors, or among communities, or for that matter, among nations.
I want to talk about politics when it comes to wrongness. On the one hand, we love to hate the leaders that we think are wrong or who have made mistakes, and yet we never quite trust the ones who have changed their positions, even if they're now on our side.
That's right. Of all spheres of life, I would say that politics has by far the most, dysfunctional relationship to being wrong. And I think we're all complicit in that. It's not just our political leaders who make that relationship to being wrong so troubled and troublesome. It's the rest of us and what we expect from within the political domain. Because you're right, politicians are they're darned if they do and they're darned if they don't. You, as a political leader, you're under a tremendous amount of pressure to get everything right. We tend to crave certainty in our leaders. We talked earlier about doubt and our general discomfort with it, and I would say that discomfort is exacerbated radically in the political realm. We really hate political leaders who, quote, waffle or waver or in any way seem to change position on issues or rethink matters or even stop and think about things instead of immediately having all of the answers at hand. And yet that kind of certainty tends to work at cross purposes to getting things right. The more certain you are, the less able you are to entertain counter evidence, to stop and think about new information that's coming along, to listen thoughtfully to people who disagree with you to see if there's something important to be learned there. And that can be catastrophic. We saw it, for example, famously with the Bay of Pigs. There's instances where absolute certainty and the refusal to listen to counter evidence is very, very dangerous. And then meanwhile, when our political leaders actually do get it wrong, we tend to clamor for apologies and admissions of error. And yet when we actually get them, very often we excoriate the leader and act as if, they never, ever should have made a mistake in the first place, even though realistically political leaders are human beings like the rest of us. And we're not going to get rid of their fallibility any more than we're going to get rid of it in ourselves.
There are certainly some positions where tolerance for wrongness is particularly low. We're not so bothered if someone gets our food order wrong at lunch, but things like, medicine and law enforcement and certainly journalism. And yet those of us in those jobs are no less fallible than anybody else.
We aren't. And I think one of the really crucial lessons to be learned about wrongness is that if you focus on trying to make us less fallible, you're going to fail. It's not, as I said, a category that we can eradicate from human existence without actually getting rid of our intelligence too, essentially throwing out the baby with the bathwater. If you want to try to prevent the negative consequences of the mistakes, you need to look not at individual human beings, who got that wrong, whose fault is this, who can we blame, but at the system that you've got in place to sort of track those human beings and take that fallibility into account. And you can bet that every mistake that gets made is a sign of a systems failure, whether the systems failure is like, oops, we have one fewer copy editor than we need, and so this slipped into the front page somehow, or, we need some kind of checklist for this medical procedure to make sure this problem never happens again.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Maureen in Austin. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. I've noticed a phenomenon with myself, especially in group situations, where if I'm right about something, it's not acknowledged. And then instead of getting more credibility for the next time something comes up and I think I'm right within that group situation, it seems that people fight even harder to convince me I'm wrong. Why does it seem that in group situations I can't ever seem to be right in something like that?
Well, it would be hard for me to speak to your specific situation without watching it unfold. But I think that you're right. Group dynamics don't tend to be very flexible and forgiving in the face of someone being right when the group felt otherwise. I think that much the same way that if you and I are in a conflict and you're right and I'm wrong, you know, there's a very good chance that I'm going to bristle when I realize that I'm wrong, and I'm going to be frustrated, and I'm going to take it out on you, and that's going to be an uncomfortable situation. That very same dynamic plays out in groups, and I think that, you know, it's difficult to counter as long as your main goal is to insist on your own rightness. I think if your main goal instead is to steer the conversation toward the content of the idea and toward really figuring out why everyone thinks what they do, you might have a little bit more luck. In fact, one of the things that's really notable to me about social dynamics around rightness and wrongness is what happens when, instead of insisting on your rightness, you step back and you say, you know, maybe I'm wrong on this one. It's my experience that that move, partly because it's so rare and tends to surprise people and kind of throw a monkey wrench into the conversation, often produces this amazing domino effect. You would think that what would happen in that moment is that other people would say, yeah, you know, you are wrong. And, of course, sometimes that's going to happen. You're going to get the person occasionally who cannot resist saying, yeah, I told you so. But very often when you step back and say, all right, maybe you guys have a point, you know, tell me what you're thinking, or maybe I'm wrong here, other people will also take that step back with you, and they'll say, oh, you know, I don't know, I think what you were saying was interesting. Maybe you do have a point. Maybe I'm not quite right on this one. There's this weird, amazing chain reaction that happens when, instead of getting defensive about rightness, you make space for the possibility of wrongness.
What does it take to sort of convert the way we think about our own lives to be more open to the possibility that we might be wrong about any number of things?
You know, honestly, I think it takes practice. and in a way, that practice is easier to come by than you would think, because I think the part of what happens is you can actually get a what I would almost call a virtuous cycle. You know, as I said, when we get into conflicts over whether we're right or wrong, they're generally pretty unpleasant. You know, I mean, if we're arguing about, you know, the best way to load the dishwasher or whatever stupid domestic conflict that people have, you know, every single day, it's not fun for me, it's not fun for you, it's just generally unpleasant all the way around. And by contrast, when you are able to step back and force yourself, even if it feels really alien and unfamiliar, to say, all right, you know what, let's do it your way, or okay, let's try that. The chemistry of that moment changes so radically. You know, instead of getting a confrontation, you tend to get a kind of intimacy that otherwise was definitely about to disappear out the door. And so, in a sense, it is a it's kind of a, as I said, a virtuous cycle. When you do it once and you realize that it's actually much more pleasurable than insisting on your rightness, it gets a little bit easier to do it the next time.
I also find it's interesting, and I guess it's what this show is wrapped up in, but just trying to figure out why people think what they think.
Right. And that, I think, is a really wonderful and crucial insight. I think, you know, I can speak to my own personal experience, which is that, you know, I think when I started working on this book, I'm a relatively stubborn, opinionated person, and probably not out of the extreme end of the spectrum, but I can hold my own in the stubbornness contest. And I wouldn't say that that's changed over the many years that I've spent working about wrongness. I still have quite a lot of convictions, and the book is in no way an argument against having convictions. But I would say that one of the things that's changed most dramatically for me, and certainly for the better, is that I've become genuinely very curious about why other people hold the beliefs that they do when those beliefs are at odds with my own. Because I think one of the things I've realized is, you know what, people who disagree with us, for the most part, they aren't ignorant, and they aren't idiotic, and they aren't evil. I mean, are there morons in the world? Of course. Are there morally corrupt people in the world? Of course. By and large, though, most people, just like me, just like you, think of themselves as moral agents trying to do right in the world. And so their beliefs come from somewhere. They come from a community. They come from a worldview. And no matter what I think of those beliefs, I think I have a level of curiosity and compassion and empathy for the person who holds them that I didn't used to have. And you know what? That is a nicer way to move through the world.
Do you find the people that you know playing amateur psychiatrist and trying to figure out why this has become something that really fascinates you?
Yes, I do find that. I get asked quite often whether, you know, there was some kind of dramatic experience of wrongness that made me write this book. And I have to tell you, I actually wish the answer were yes. You know, I wish I
could
say,
make for a good story.
Yeah, exactly. You know, oh, I was 29 years old and I found out I was adopted or something. It would be a wonderful story. And the only problem with that story is that it's not true. I don't have a kind of catastrophic experience of wrongness in my own life. And the book itself is the farthest thing in the world from a memoir. I mean, my own voice crops up in it. I occasionally tell a story at my expense, but it's not particularly about me and my life and my relationship to wrongness. And I think, I'm sure it did help that on some level, you know, as I said, I am someone who's stubborn and opinionated, and I found myself drawn into that dynamic of insisting on my own rightness. I'm sure that played a role in my interest in the book, but overall, I would say it was a much larger curiosity about the idea of error and sort of recognizing it as this category that is, as I said earlier, omnipresent in our lives and affects almost every domain of existence, and really starting to wonder, what happens if we isolate that category and look at what's in it and start thinking about the world through that lens.
So does it surprise you then that more people don't really think about this question very often?
You know, I wouldn't say that I'm surprised that people don't think about it, because I think we have kind of an aversive reaction to wrongness. You know, we treat them like cockroaches or something. It's like, kill that, get rid of it, and get me away from it, and then let me not think about it ever again. So I'm not surprised that most people in their daily lives don't think about it. If anything, I've been surprised by the converse, which is that, since the book came out, which was in early June, I've been on the road talking about it quite a lot, and I've been really wonderfully surprised by how eager people are to talk about being wrong. In the moment of our own mistakes, I think most of us, that's when we have the aversive response, and we just feel embarrassed and kind of want to crawl away and don't want to think about it. Or if we think about it, it's kind of late at night with a cringe. But in the abstract, when you give people a chance to think about these ideas, not when they're sort of in the middle of suffering their own mistake, but to really step back and look at, okay, how does this affect my own personal life, and how does this affect our culture and our country? Then people are actually, I'm finding, very, very eager to talk about this and really quite insightful and thoughtful about it.
Have you learned a sort of gracious substitute for our overwhelming impulse to say, I told you so?
It's funny you should ask this. I wrote a little while ago, I wrote a piece for the Freakonomics blog over at the New York Times, and the piece is called something like Crowdsourcing a Better Way to Deal with Being Wrong, because I was thinking about exactly that question. You know, what can we do instead of saying, I told you so? What can we do about our own mistakes? What can we do when we're right and other people are wrong to handle those situations more gracefully? And I was thrilled to see that the readers of the New York Times who responded to this were much more clever than I and actually had come up with quite a lot of wonderful ways to field that. But I do think there's some almost kind of practical tools you can use. And one of my favorites of these is a friend of mine who has come up with this rule.
We've just got about 10 seconds. I'm sorry to speed
you
along.
The rule is very simple. You get one I told you so per friend per lifetime.
So use it wisely.
Exactly.
Catherine Schultz is a journalist who has written for publications including the New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone. Her new book is called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Catherine, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Pleasure was mine. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.